I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Federal immigration officials are touting the arrests of three undocumented men with criminal records in Philadelphia. All three were recently released from city custody when they were picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that the arrests come as the feds continue to pressure Philadelphia to change its so-called sanctuary city policy.
ICE says the arrests of the three men reflect the agency's priorities, targeting for deportation undocumented immigrants who commit crimes. But as a sanctuary city, Philadelphia bars local law enforcement from keeping immigrants in custody on the agency's behalf. Thomas Decker, a local ICE official, says if that policy weren't in place, the men would have been apprehended sooner.
These are really good arrests, making the community safe, but at the same time, hoping that the city of Philadelphia will see, like, you know, working together, we can make the city safe and also make these arrests inside a facility instead of outside in the streets.
But Mayor Jim Kenney has resisted changes, arguing the policy protects immigrants who are living here illegally but are otherwise law-abiding residents. The policy does allow the city to detain those convicted of a violent felony, so long as ICE has a warrant.
The last time that they complained about this, the guy had re-entered the country allegedly illegally. That's a felony violation of federal law. They could get a warrant, and we would have turned them right over. But they want to kind of have a blanket ability to ask us to hold people against the Constitution without a warrant.
While ICE insists cooperation between the city and the feds would be easier and safer for everyone, Kenney says these recent arrests show the agency doesn't need the city's help to do its job. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
A shooting between a Bridgeton, New Jersey homeowner and two state troopers last month could be due to a communication mix-up. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the shooting occurred when police went to the wrong house after a 911 call.
The emergency call had actually come from Millville, but police were directed to a home in Bridgeton. That's because county dispatchers accidentally sent the 911 report to another nearby town, which then sent troopers to the wrong address. When the troopers arrived at the Bridgeton property, homeowner Gerald Sykes mistook them for trespassers. He grabbed his shotgun. Minutes later, Sykes and the troopers exchanged fire. Sykes was hit three times, and one of the troopers suffered a graze wound when Sykes fired a shotgun blast through his back door. Here's part of a 911 call Sykes made just after the shooting, before he knew he'd been shot by cops.
And they were staying out there, and all of a sudden, they just shot three times through the glass door.
Who did? The two
guys out on the porch.
The two guys on the porch.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was two guys on your porch and they shot at you?
Yes, they did.
Who shot first is still in question. The state attorney general's office is investigating. Sykes spent several days in the hospital before returning home. Brian Fontes, head of the National Emergency Number Association, says 911 centers in rural areas can occasionally fail to coordinate the details of a call.
And so as a result of that, there may be, not that there necessarily would be, but there may be some information that is either corrupted or doesn't transfer exactly.
Until the investigation is complete, officials won't say for sure that's what happened in Bridgeton last month. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Governor Chris Christie says his decision 3 years ago to have New Jersey participate in the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act was the right one. Christie's praising that part of the landmark health law, even though he and Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump are calling for repealing the main parts of Obamacare.
Christie says expansion has allowed more than 500,000 residents to get health insurance coverage under Medicaid and has reduced the state's share of health care expenditures. He's ordering some changes so the state no longer pays for mental health services that aren't used.
We are one of just a few states left who continue to pay for these things in a blanket way rather than pay fee for service. We're not going to do that any longer. The extensions that we've given are over.
Christie says if the federal government reduces promised reimbursement levels, future governors should have the option to opt out of Medicaid expansion. He's critical of other parts of the Affordable Care Act, citing double-digit increases in premiums and decisions by insurers to drop out of exchanges across the country. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Theater Philadelphia, an umbrella group running the annual Barrymore Awards for Theater Excellence, announced earlier today that 41 shows from last season have been nominated for the awards. Winners will be announced at a ceremony in October. One of those winners is already known. She's Sarah Goranzik, who's led the Philadelphia Theater Company for 35 years. She'll be getting a Lifetime Achievement Barrymore Award at a time that's a turning point for her. Coincidentally, Goranzik announced last week that she was stepping down from her longtime role. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro spoke with her today.
Well, congratulations, Sarah Goranzik. It's been a quite a week for you.
Yes, it has.
Today, you know, it's announced that you are getting the Barrymore Award for Lifetime Achievement in your theater work. And you announced a few days ago that you're out of here. Well, at least from the Philadelphia Theater Company.
Sort of out of here. Not entirely.
You know, you're the longest running show, arguably, in the city, as far in the arts community, from what I can figure out. Now, maybe somebody's beat you by a year. 35 years is a long time.
It is a
long
run.
I don't know. I can't think of anybody. I want to know, though, why now?
Why not now is the question. 35 to me is this incredible benchmark where it feels like if I can't step away from my company when it's 35 years and we're in financially good shape and we have everything in front of us, when is the time? And that was the question that sort of drove me all throughout this past year when I was thinking, well, maybe I should be doing something else. And what else can I be doing? And what can I be doing to make theater that doesn't involve a great deal of administrative load and daily work?
Well, let's talk about that daily work and administrative load. Because you are right now known as executive producing director.
Indeed.
Am I right?
Yes.
Well, tell us what an executive producing director does.
Oh, my God. What doesn't an executive producing director do? Well, there's things that I do organizationally, and then there's things that I do specifically regarding the productions. So the easy part is the production part of it. I'm a producer, and I'm proud to wear that helm, that mantle, I should say. To be a producer is to be focused on creating all of the best conditions possible to make the art great, as great as it possibly could be. Artistically, also to locate the perfect audience, to create a base of funding support that will allow you to do that kind of work and be adventuresome at times. It's kind of the whole package. So that's sort of been my focus, is the whole package, really. And that really speaks to what I've been doing organizationally at Philadelphia Theater Company.
Well, let's talk about the nitty-gritty a little bit.
What about that?
You pick the plays.
I do. It's
That's
my
where
fault.
It starts.
All my fault. Completely. The blame stops here.
Are there some that you are really proud that you picked?
Oh, definitely. I mean, most of them, I feel that there always has been a really solid, fundamental choice why this work should be done at a certain time in our region or rolled out for the world if it's a world premiere. I think there's always a compelling reason for just about everything that we have done. That's the first thing that I really care about, is should this work be done, you know, now? And so when I think about that, I think of some of the things that we've done along the way that have been important to us as an institution and to a city. And there's so many. I mean, we've done, like, you know, since I've been there, you know, about 150 productions of World and Philadelphia premieres. And certain things have really propelled this institution ahead. For example, the obvious one was when we did the world premiere of Masterclass and began a long relationship with the playwright Terrence McNally. And this new play kind of won the Tony. It did
it
win the Tony.
Kind of.
It won the Tony, and it would had a life that continues on today, and it's traveled all over the world. And it was an extraordinary journey for Philadelphia Theater Company at the time.
Okay, so after 35 years in Philly, it seems to me that you've achieved the maybe the moniker of spokesperson or statesperson is what I should say, a stateswoman.
I feel like Eleanor Roosevelt.
And first you get this Lifetime Achievement Award.
I feel like Mother Time.
And you're also
Can I
you
say
know,
something?
Stepping down. Yeah.
I'm not retiring. Can I say that?
Yes,
I'll
please.
Say that 100 times. I am so not retiring. in terms of lifetime achievement, I have an awful lot of achievement ahead of me, I hope. And even though I've had the time of my life, I have an awful lot in front of me. And I want to continue producing and making theater and supporting theater as much as I possibly can, just in a slightly different way, maybe a bit less administratively focused.
Well, we wish you the very best, Sarah Gronzik. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still ahead this evening, Olympic hurdler and Germantown resident Nia Ali reflects on the camaraderie of the Rio Summer Games.
You're so grateful that they came and they did their part just as well as you did. So it's like, thank you, like, for helping me become a part of history, because I could have just been another silver medalist.
Returning home after sweeping the women's 100-meter hurdles when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The United States blew away the competition at the Rio Olympics, capturing 121 medals. Three of them came from one event, the women's 100-meter hurdles. WHYY's Aaron Mozell sat down with the silver medalist from that race to talk about the historic 1-2-3 finish for the American team.
Nia Ali, who grew up in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood, says there's a general antsy feeling at the starting line right before an Olympic track race begins. She couldn't wait for the starting gun to go off.
I just hate the feeling of waiting, especially for a final. Once they go down the lane to introduce people, I'm always counting the lanes, and I'm like, okay, she's in lane 6, she's in lane 7.
And yet those nerves didn't seem to make a difference, even though this was her first Olympics.
At the gun, they go over the first hurdle.
12.59 seconds later, Ali had won Olympic silver.
It is a U.S. sweep, the first sweep in this event in Olympic history.
Teammate Brianna Rollins won gold, Christy Castlin the bronze. Ali says she doesn't remember the first few hurdles.
I remember separating from the field on my side, but seeing Brianna, like, out the corner of my eye and realizing that she was stepping down, like, in front. So I was like, okay, I hit a sweet spot where I kind of just moved really well in the middle of the race and just held on to it. And I remember crossing the line knowing for the first time the position that I finished in.
From the stands, Melita Johnson, Ali's mom and unofficial manager, was near tears.
The Netherlands were, like, right down there in front of us. So since they saw us up there and they saw us with our flag and everything, they jumped on the team with us. And then after the race, they all charged up to us. And it was just like a big bear hug. Like, everybody started jumping on us and they were screaming like they were our family with us.
Ali says, yeah, winning gold would have been sweet. But she says the U.S. sweeping all three medals overshadows that.
You're so grateful that they came and they did their part just as well as you did. So it's like, thank you, like, for helping me become a part of history, because I could have just been another silver medalist.
Ali started running on an organized team when she was just 6 years old. And until high school, she was always the fastest.
I mean, I raced someone in fourth grade who, like, kind of tied me, and they made a big deal at my school about it. But it wasn't until probably eighth grade until the guy started to, like, surpass me and take off.
It wasn't until senior year of high school that Ali considered track to be a ticket to being a professional athlete, an Olympian. She took it seriously before then, but she had other interests, like dancing.
Modern, tap, jazz, hip-hop, ethnic, like, all types.
Ali also played basketball and, for a little while, softball and tennis. Track, though, was always number one, even when she had to jump hurdles in her personal life. In 2009, Ali's father died in a murder-suicide in nearby West Oak Lane. In 2015, she gave birth to her son, Titus.
I mean, I guess I just kind of realized how to just roll with the punches and just embrace my journey. Even if that's in track, if my season is, like, going down and I know I'm supposed to be running faster, I know that there's light at the end.
Johnson says that attitude is a huge part of her daughter's success.
She'll be overseas and, like, say she'll get fifth or sixth place and not run the time that she wanted to run. And she'll say something so funny about the race, and she'll be like, well, I can only get faster. And then we'll just start laughing.
Since returning to the U.S., Ali says she's had to adjust to her newfound stardom. Before Rio, she wasn't a household name.
I got in an Uber one day, and he's like, puts on the brakes, like, that's me, Ali. Like, the silver medalist? Oh my gosh, can I take a picture? And I think, like, that's so funny.
And overall, she says the exposure is a good thing.
I want to be able to be an inspiration. So I want more children to be like, who's that? And like to know who I am so I can kind of talk to them and lead the way, especially from my area. I grew up with people who I thought were very talented who didn't make it to where I thought they would. So I'm like, I don't want to see that keep happening.
Ali has a few weeks off before getting back to training. The World Championships in London are a little less than a year from now. She's not sure if she'll be back at the Olympics.
You just got to take it like year by year. I had no idea I would be here even last year. So, yeah, we'll see what twists and turns come along the way.
I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Turns out the lazy dog days of summer aren't so lazy. Let's pick up the pace with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. And Derek, we don't have to go far. Just stay right here on planet Earth.
Yeah, it's amazing that when we talk about motion, you know, we shake our heads thinking, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm sitting perfectly still here in the studio. But in fact, if we look at all of the motions of our planet, it turns out that they're quite surprising. The first one, of course, is what we call daily motion, diurnal motion. That's the Earth's rotation on its axis. If we were at the equator, we could measure that motion at about 1,000 miles per hour. Curiously, if we go to the top of the planet on either end, our relative motion is zero. It is interesting that as we stand on the planet, we don't feel this. We don't seem to feel this. And it is because we are so close to the mass itself that's moving that we have no sense of that motion, really.
And then we can step off the mass, and then there's a whole other motion at play.
Oh, there are so many other motions at play. You know, the other one that we think of almost immediately is what's called revolution. And that's the Earth's motion in its orbit around the sun. And that's something that takes 365 days a year. The size of the orbit is 600 million miles, and if we were to try to clock that speed, it would be at about 66,000 miles per hour.
Do NASA spaceships go 66,000 miles an hour?
Oh my gosh, no. They don't go anywhere near that. The fastest spacecraft ever, I believe, is nearly 50,000 miles per hour. The New Horizons spacecraft went as fast as any spacecraft could ever go. But that's not all. There's still more that goes along with this. We have to count the motion of the entire solar system itself. So think about the sun as a star, having its own motion in our galaxy, the Milky Way. Independent of anything else, our star is chugging along through the Milky Way. And, of course, it carries all of the planets that we know of, all the asteroids, all the comets, all the meteors, all those bodies. And that speed is really incredible. It's 43,000 miles per hour. And the Milky Way also rotates on its axis. And if we just mark where we are right now, and do one whole rotation all the way around the galaxy, that's about 230 years.
That's a galactic year.
That would be a galactic year, 230 years. And at that rate, if you break it all down, that means it's all moving at a speed of 515,000 miles per hour.
We're starting to approximate the speed of light.
You would think we'd feel a breeze by now, right? Okay, so still more has to be added yet. If we look at the Milky Way's motion through the universe itself, well, we're moving at a rate of 1.3 million miles per hour.
Moving away from what, the Big Bang?
Well, that's always a great question. And in fact, this measurement is probably the most difficult of all to make. And the reason why it's the most difficult of all to make, because we have to have a fixed reference point against which we can measure motion. So we choose a way in which we can fix that by looking at the cosmic microwave background and establishing the way in which that energy has been stretching along with the entire stretch of the universe as it's been expanding since the Big Bang. So as we look around us, all of the galaxies are all receding from each other.
Is there a consensus that that expansion is taking place at an ever-accelerating rate?
Oh, yes. Now we clearly understand that it's happening at an accelerating rate. And this takes us back then to the discussions about dark matter and dark energy. At one point, we were thinking that because of the lack of identification of mass needed in the universe, that the universe would slow down in its expansion. When we found that the galaxies were indeed increasing in their recessional velocity, that led us down a whole other path to be considered, and hence we now pin that responsibility on dark matter and dark energy.
Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.